311, Senate Bill 489, Senate Bill 378, Senate Bill 381, Senate Bill 392.
Meeting will come to order. Clerk, call a roll.
Here.
Senator Rogers. Senator Hall. Senator Windorf.
Here.
Mr. Chairman.
Here. One thing I'd like to find out on these bills, how many of you are from out of town and would find it a little difficult to come back for another hearing if we got hung up? That Senate Bill 311, any from out of town on 489, 378, 381, 392. We got three there. I think we'll go ahead with our regular schedule, and then we do fall a little bit behind while we might move Senate Bill 392 up, since there are three members here from out of town we'd like to take care of. Senate Bill 311, Jerry Mendel.
Mendel.
Excuse me, Jerry. Thanks for the correction, Senator Hall.
You'd like to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gerald J. Mendel, and I'm engaged in a private practice of law with offices in Portland, Oregon. I represent CIT Corporation, which is the principal sponsor of this bill, and I am appearing today on behalf of my client in support of Senate Bill 311. CIT Corporation has been serving the industrial financing needs of the West and Northwest United States for many years through its offices in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, and Seattle. These offices are part of a network of over 20 divisional offices located in many states throughout the country. CIT Corporation is a subsidiary of CIT Financial Corporation, which has a capital and surplus of over $600 million. It has been established and doing business for more than 60 years and is the largest financial institution of its kind in the United States. My client is not engaged in making automobile, personal, or consumer loans, as it specializes in financing retail sales of road machinery, machine tools, and other types of industrial and production equipment, and makes direct working capital loans to creditworthy business and industrial firms. I have with me, and who will testify, Mr. Doug Brown from New York, who has been with CIT Corporation for 27 years, and he will be able to answer any questions any member of this committee may have concerning CIT Corporation, the type of loans it makes, and how it does business. Money is like any other commodity, and to a large extent is governed by an old economic law of supply and demand. If there is a lot of money available and demand for loans is small, interest rates naturally are low. On the other hand, if there is a shortage of money and demand is great, the interest rates become higher. At the present time, the money market is loosened, money is available, and if the money situation were to continue as it now is, there would not be any need for Senate Bill 311. But the money market changes very rapidly. It was only a few months ago that there was a need in Oregon for Senate Bill 311. Money was scarce, just plainly not available. If any member of this committee had reason a few months ago to borrow money, I am sure that member knows how difficult it was to secure a loan. The purpose of Senate Bill 311 is simply to have this law taking the limit on interest rates off of loans to corporations, so that in the event we again come to a tight money market, it will be possible for organizations like CIT Corporation to help help out by making funds available to businesses seeking money in Oregon. I believe it should be of interest to this committee to take a look at other states as far as corporation loans are concerned. Alabama, 15% if original balance over 10,000. Arizona, 18% on loans in excess of 5,000. Connecticut, 18% on loans in excess of 10,000. Delaware, no limit. Florida, 15%. Georgia, no limit on loans in excess of 2,500. Illinois, no limit. Indiana, no limit. Iowa, no limit. Kansas, no limit. Kentucky, no limit. Louisiana, no limit. Maine, no limit on loans in excess of 2,500. Maryland, no limit on loans in excess of 5,000. Massachusetts, 20% on loans in excess of 3,000. Michigan, no limit. Minnesota, no limit. Mississippi, 15% on loans in excess of 2,500. Missouri, no limit. Nebraska, no limit. New Hampshire, no limit. New Jersey, no limit. New Mexico, no limit. New York, 25%. North Dakota, no limit. Ohio, no limit. Oklahoma, no limit. Pennsylvania, no limit. Rhode Island, 21%. South Carolina, no limit if capitalization over 40,000. South Dakota, no limit. Texas, 1.5% per month on loans in excess of 5,000. Utah, no limit in excess of 25,000. Virginia, no limit. West Virginia, no limit. Wisconsin, 20%. I cite the above states and limitations on loans to corporations to point out to this committee as clearly as I possibly can that in the event of a tight money market, an organization like CIT will naturally put their funds for making loans into a state where the interest rate is more favorable than the state of Oregon. Therefore, it would be clearly to the advantage of Oregon business, and for that matter, Oregon labor because of jobs, to remove the ceiling that we now have a 12% on loans to corporations, so that in the event of another tight money market, money would be available to start new businesses and keep existing businesses in operation. CIT, in addition to using its own capital and surplus for lending purposes, borrows from banks and through short-term commercial paper and bonds sold to the public for the funds that it uses. In other words, CIT has to pay interest rates upon some of the money it uses in making loans. In addition, CIT takes many credit risks and extends service facilities not customarily taken or given by banks or similar lenders. Where a borrower is unable to secure sufficient finances from a bank or a similar lender, a borrower naturally is required to pay a higher rate of interest for the availability of these facilities. Of course, local financial institutions have lending facilities that do supply credit facilities, but as a historical fact, that both the banks and CIT work together, complementing each other in all states where CIT has a direct loan program. There's not only room, but a need for both types of lending facilities. Since banks use depositors' money in their lending programs, they are required to be conservative in their business loans. Furthermore, they are restricted by state banking departments in the types and terms of loans that can be made. These restrictions, while necessary to protect the depositors, often prevent banks from granting credit to worthy borrowers. CIT and similar organizations are not so restricted and are permitted to make higher risk loans. CIT will, because of specialized facilities and experience in particular fields such as highway contractors, lumber businesses, and others, finance businesses that are not at the time of the loan acceptable to banking institutions. But as a borrower's credit strength grows, that borrower becomes bankable and able to borrow from banks. As a matter of fact, CIT and banks often finance together. CIT will make a long-term financing available, and the local bank will finance the borrower's short-term requirements for wages, taxes, supplies, etc. In this way, the borrower obtains a higher total credit. The passage of this bill will not automatically increase rates onto this loan. Bank rates will remain available for present and prospective borrowers who can qualify for bank loans. The several companies who are active in the industrial loan field will compete with each other to obtain non-bank business. Their only method of competition is to offer superior service and the lowest possible rates. In closing, my client CIT Corporation respectfully asks your serious consideration in removing the limit of interest rate on loans to corporations. Obviously, by doing this, it will not affect the consumer loan, individual loan, etc. In other words, it can do no harm to anyone. When the corporation makes a loan, it is not an inexperienced person but knows what it is doing. On the other hand, the passage of Senate Bill 311 would, in the event of a period of tight money, which may occur again as the money market changes very rapidly, give a shot in the arm to the Oregon economy and make money available to Oregon corporations that need money to expand, start, or keep growing. In other words, the passage of this bill to bring money into Oregon for these worthwhile purposes rather than to have this outside money go to other states in such periods of time that do not have the limit that Oregon has under its present law. Same, Mr. Chairman, I do have Mr. Brown here who can answer any specific questions, but I'd be very happy to answer any questions I may
ask. Just a minute before you do, Jerry, have you read Senate Bill 489?
Yes, I have.
Would you comment on that? The Mortgage Bank Association. Do you have a copy there?
I don't, but I have something on the 50,000. I can understand the reason for that. Yes, Mr. Chairman. If that figure were 25,000, Mr. Chairman, we would probably would be in favor of it. We might not be pushing Senate Bill 311, but we make a lot of loans that are less than 50,000.
Now, Senator Broner.
Jerry, I remember when Universal CIT came in several years ago for 12% usury for corporations, you recall that?
Yes.
Now, you mentioned a number of states in the union that where the usury rates are higher or the usury rates are out altogether.
Yes.
Can you substantiate that the economy is better in those states during this tight money policy? Do you have any evidence, for example, when employment was less, that the economy was better because of the universal CIT and the banks were able to make loans and charge a higher rate of interest? Can you produce this evidence?
Well, Senator Groener, I can't say that I can produce this evidence, but if I might suggest they're doing business in all these states. Perhaps that's your question better than I can.
I've seen some states that you mentioned there where conditions are not probably even economy worse than here in Oregon.
But Senator Groener, just supposing money is not available, and say you had $100 million to loan out, where would you put it?
Well, I had $100 million to loan out, and I could charge the corporations any rate of interest that I cared to. That's where I'd loan my money in the hell of a homeowner. But then I want to build a home.
This doesn't affect homeowners at all.
I know it doesn't, but if the banks only have a certain amount of money, your financial institutions only have a certain amount of money to loan. If I can make a loan and get 25% interest, I'm certainly not going to. I'm going to loan it out at 25% interest rather than the 6 or 7 or 8 or 9% to a man that wants to build a house. And I think this is where it helps our economy is especially here in Oregon, where we can pour money into the market as far as home building is concerned. The lumber industry will certainly benefit us. Number one in our economy.
But Senator, I do think it'd be kind of a help. Be able to have outside money come in here to help the tight money market. This is what this bill would do.
What I'm afraid of is local money. You have all these other states, in the union, with a high, that's probably where their money would go. But the bank, at least the local financial institutions, instead of going the same route, Thinking here, Jerry, we loan the money to corporations where they can get a higher return.
Those types of loans, because of the higher risk and examination by the bank examiners, these are loans that the banks can have money.
Well, a banking examiner, if the law is the laws, and if we allow, if we take the lid off the usury as part of corporation concern, the banking examiner can't do anything about it. I mean, you can charge any rate you want.
You can charge the rate, but a person who can get his loan from the bank is not going to come to us. We can loan money that the bank cannot. So that means that.
Yeah, but are you going to make loans on mortgages in Universal CIP if the banks loan all their money, local banks loan out all their money in Oregon corporations? Are you going to make 8, 7, 8, 9% mortgage loans? Universal CIP?
I doubt it'd be in that.
This is where it really helps our economy.
I doubt it'd be in that business center. But take a business that needs the money, they cannot get it from the bank, then this type of organization does.
Don't misunderstand me, Jerry. I think that you really believe this bill or you wouldn't be here lobbying for it.
Senator, I never lobbied for a bill that I did not believe in.
I realize that.
Mr. Chairman, I have copies of my statement committee. I also have.
Yes, we'd like to have a copy of that.
I have the annual report of CIT and Nancy and I do a book which I'd like to leave committee of finance. And if I might, then call Doug Brown.
Thank you, Jerry. Mr. Brown?
Yes, sir. My name is Douglas Brown. I'm a vice president of CIT Corporation, CIT Leasing Corporation. We wear two hats. They get twice as much work out of us. I came out to answer any questions at all that may be answered. Some of the questions we read in our business you can't answer, but I think most of them I can. Appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman. Somebody come out here, and I'll handle it any way you want. Start shooting questions or ask me for a brief off-the-cuff statement.
I want to ask you the same question. Are you familiar with Senate Bill 489, the $50,000?
I am, not to the extent that Mr. Mendel is, but I understand it.
Would you comment on that? Do you think that's too high? Or?
No, I can comment on it, sir, to this extent. That we have found in our experience in various states that when you separate the financial problems into various types, that it's often helpful. As an example, over the years, and Senator Groner commented before on Universal CIT, with which, other than at the very top, our company has nothing to do with. They're in a completely different field than I am. They tried to help in many instances. States put through installment sales regulatory acts by suggesting reasonable things to get rid of the curses that some people in the finance business had caused and put through reasonable legislation, which let legitimate people in that field operate successfully, and they hope for the benefit of the man who wanted to buy an automobile or an appliance or whatever they were financing. Often, our company, which dealt with a completely different market, got tangled in because at the last minute somebody put it in as an old goods bill. And when we got tied in with the problems of that were properly regulated in the Installment Sales Regulatory Acts, it caused us trouble in that we couldn't do certain things which we thought were for the benefit of the type of borrower or seller of machinery with which we work. And we weren't able to perform our function in that competitive market as well as if we've been treated with separately. And I think possibly here that, as Mr. Mendel says, we take the $25,000. We do a lot of desirable business in the $20,000 to $50,000 range for the smaller business who is on its way up. And of course, those people could be cut out if we ran into a situation such as we've had here for the last year and a half. I don't mean here, country as a whole.
So you wouldn't have many under 20,000?
We have them, but let's put it this way, that the most of those are transactions that sellers of machinery create themselves, and we can treat with those in a different way. But when the man comes to us directly to either raise working capital or to buy machinery, and we have to deal with him solely, of course, then we're in a loan situation, and that's where we've had our problems.
Well, you say you'd buy 489 if it said $20,000.
Well, 25, as Mr. mentioned, I think the figure was used was 25. I said we do have a number of transactions in the 20 to 50,000, but it was like 5,000 one way or the other way, it would be too unhappy.
Well, following up what Senator Warner asked,
yes.
If Oregon passed, if Oregon had limits, then it would join a lot of states with no user limits or with higher user limits. Mm-hmm. And that would encourage the infusion of massive new amounts of capital, risk capital, according to Mr. Mendel. We would join whatever the list that you read totals, 35 or 40 or however many.
Roughly, that's true.
How much can you estimate monetarily or in terms of percentage of the monies that you would spread and you spread throughout the United States? How much would we benefit in terms of any given year or decade or whatever by?
All right. If I may, I'd like to just give you a bit of history. We were perfectly happy in Oregon and couple of other states.
You gotta learn how to pronounce the name of the state.
I'm anxious.
Oregon. Right.
I will remember that. And this isn't the first time I've gotten in trouble. I'll have to say it three times to myself to be sure I got it right. We ran into this situation. We were happy with the 12%. We were doing business. We have an office in Portland, as Mr. Mendel said. I'll give you an example of what happened. We continue and have continued right through the tight money crunch to make many millions of dollars available in Oregon to sellers of machinery that work with us. But whether that's a loan or not, that's their problem. It's not ours. We simply have an understanding with the seller that we put up all kinds of money, furnished documentation services, do credit checking, do the collection work, perform a lot of services. But in the field that we are talking about particularly today, and I might just draw the lines on it, it's best represented in, I'd say, three aspects. One is what we might call working capital loans, where a deserving business needs money. And we go in and put up money for his working capital. Number two, many times a buyer of machinery wants to buy pieces of equipment from various sources. Now, he might be able to work individual time payment arrangements with each seller, but this gets awkward. So he comes to us, he's creditworthy, we say, fine, you want to buy admin in a machinery? Got our okay, you go ahead. When the sellers ship the machinery, let us know, we'll pay them off, and then you deal with us on and on. And another field that we operate in is in the growing business, which creates open cash receivable. We do what is known as commercial financing, which is simply loaning money against receivable, short term receivable. Now, that type of business, by the way, a man, if we pick the right one, he gets in a position in several years where he doesn't need that type of financing. That's where a company is growing very rapidly and has to be able to generate credit with all he's got, which is a mounting list of receivables. Now, once he gets business in hand and gets the thing straightened out, he pays us off, and we are very proud of the graduates from that school. That's for principally the growing business. It's going a little bit better with the capital that we set in there. But when the money tightness came up, and this prevailed for, I'd say, the last half of 69 and all through the year of 1970, our office in Portland, which had working in the state approximately $40 million, last year dropped off about, oh, I would guess 25 to maybe 30% of that type of business, because they could not put the money out at the rate. For the reasons Mr. Mendel said, money has to go where it can earn the most if you want to stay in business. Another thing, too, mentioning the banks, our vice president down there in Portland told me this morning when I asked him that last year he had innumerable referrals of business from the banks for two reasons. First, somewhat tightness on their part of money. They didn't have as much as they wanted. Secondly, we do often very different transactions. We go on terms that stretch out as far as 8 to 12 years on heavy machinery purchases. Banks generally, if they go into a term loan situation, usually like knock it off with about 3. Some will go out a little farther when things are good. So often they will get with us on that type of transaction, feeling that they have an area in which they can operate, in which they can beat us at it, let's put it. But in the longer term field, and with our knowledge of machinery and equipment and our ability in passing credit to rely upon the value that that machinery has and the value that it will have to our buyer, in other words, machinery is our specialty, but help.
Yes,
that's the question of Jerry about home loans here in Oregon. Mm-hmm. The banks, the ceiling was off the banks and
right.
Other financial institutions. I'm sure, like Universal CIT, that's where the money would go, the dollars would go, wherever possible. Mm-hmm. It'd be in competition with you for this type of loan. Do you have any fear that the mortgage market
Universal CIT, for example, which has been primarily a consumer finance company, is not in the first mortgage business.
I realize that.
That's right. It is doing some second mortgage work in certain states. CIT Corporation itself does not do any residential mortgage.
I realize that.
I don't think, if now the people that we would and do the financing for, of course, are not the, they're the people who build, the people who construct, the people who sell the machinery that's needed to end up making these homes. I don't think there'll be any connection.
Okay. Second. I forget the year we passed this 12% limitation.
Raised 10 years, maybe.
Yeah, I was there at that time. But the same statement was made, you're raising more money is going into Oregon. Can you tell us how much money went into Oregon prior to that bill and how much a year afterwards? Or below?
I can't tell you precisely, but I think that there isn't any question that the outstanding in our office in Oregon, I'll get it, probably grew 50 to 75%, which meant there was capital coming in.
One more question.
Yes.
What's the maximum interest you have charged in a state where the lid is off? Maximum interest where the lid is off?
Well, I can tell you very quickly, just take one area. As I said, this type of borrower comes in for working capital, he's a corporation, and a businessman, some of them quite large, or he wants the money to buy heavy machinery and equipment. I never would have believed this a few years ago, but last year our rates got up as high as 15, what we call actuarial, which is, in other words, effective rate of interest. And we were getting, obviously, 15%.
Is that discount? Or?
No, that's actuarial rate of interest, or what we call effective rate of interest. You know, whether you couch it as a discount or an add-on charge or even interest bearing with an add-on charge, this is what we would, it's the effective rate of interest, which incidentally under your Truth in Lending Act is the thing that the federal government says you got to expose.
15% on the unpaid balance or?
No, it's a
discount.
It's a, as though you've got, you put a dollar in the bank and they give you 15% per annum.
I see.
That's what it is. And as I said, I would never believe that it was possible we were going to go that high.
Well, why would you want to take the lid off then? Why not set it at 50, raise it from 12 to 15 if that's the maximum you've ever charged in any state in the union?
Incidentally, incidentally, we did not have different rates for different states when we raised our rate. Now, we stayed out of certain states, but we did not raise the rate in just one state or another. And we don't do things that way in our company. We operate on a national basis. So often we're working with sellers and people who sell all over the country, so get us an element. If we charge a different rate in different states, we don't charge what the traffic is bearing, let's put it that way. We charge what we think will cover our operating expenses and leave us a reasonable profit.
But 15% is the most you've ever charged?
That was the last year's high.
In any state?
In any state.
Okay, then what would be wrong, again, what would be wrong with putting a limitation, raising the rate from 12 to 15, rather than taking the lid off?
Let's put it this way. I think you helped us considerably when you went up to 12, whether it was 10 years ago, and certainly we put a lot of good money to work in the state, and I think to good purpose for the people in the state for that length of time. And at that time, if you'd have asked any of us, is it going to go to 12 and over, we'd have probably all sat around and said no. But at that time, we were borrowing on a commercial paper basis at around 4%. We had some long-term debt at around 3%. And last year we paid 8 7/8 for 15 to 30 day money, and that type of borrowing represents half of our borrowing, the other half is long term. So we just had an unprecedented situation.
One more. Are you operating in the state of Washington?
Yes, we are.
You have a 12% simple.
We sure do.
How do you buy that? I mean, how do you operate?
Last year we didn't buy it. We were in the same spot there as we are here. We
did you borrow any money last year under the 12%?
Not on our loan program. We bought, we had business in the state, as I say, we continue to do business here in the other areas that we operate. But we had the same problem up there. And now to the south, you've got your California, which is no limit as long as you qualify under the Personal Property Brokers Act. Which means that anything over $5,000, you can negotiate the transaction, and your competitors are in there negotiating it too. There's nothing like competition to keep people on their toes, whether it be up or down.
Any further questions?
Just one question.
Yes, Senator.
Do you operate internationally or
We did operate internationally to our great sorrow, sir. We had an operation in Great Britain, and we had one in Germany, and we were very fortunate to find somebody that wanted to buy the one in Germany, and we were very unfortunate not being able to find anybody who wanted to buy the one in Great Britain, nor could we get the money back that we put over there. So I would say that we don't like it. We're in Canada with a separate company, and of course we're in the 50 United States and in Puerto Rico, but not at all.
Yes, that is correct.
What are the interest rates in, say, in Germany? What are your rates there?
Well, I tell you, as a matter of fact, the rates over there, I don't remember the exact percentages because I didn't handle the operation, but they were quite high, and incidentally too, the reason we didn't like that operation is because we couldn't borrow enough money over there to bring the thing up to the what we call economical size. We had a good operation in the industrial field, somewhat similar to what we're doing here, but money just wasn't available. We couldn't pump it in. We had to borrow it locally.
You couldn't because of the law?
That's right, yes. We formed a Swiss company and put money in that, but there was a limit on how much. And then the other two companies had to draw out of that. And most of the rest of the money we had to get from German banks. And they just weren't able to put up enough to keep It's not a growth. It grew to a certain level and then it just sank.
Give me some idea of what the interest rate was.
Oh, it was probably 14-15% at a time when we were dealing in the 10 area. Now, if you want to make a lot of money and are willing to take the risk, just put it down in South America. We can get 30%. But we don't know whether we've got a business from one day to the next. So we have never done it.
One more question.
Yes.
Is it international, is it laws of the United States, federal government, to keep you from taking money out of the country investing over there, or is it the law of that particular country that you should invest in?
Well, you know, there's been a little thing called balance of payments. And under that, there has been a, let's put it, it's only been a request that American lending institutions not put more money abroad than for a long time. It ran 105% of what they had, say, about 1963.
Well,
and that's what held us down.
My point is this. Would you not, because of the money you could get in a foreign country, wouldn't you, if you could, invest most of your money in foreign investments rather than the United States because the interest rate is so much higher?
No, as a matter of fact, you know, I think when I figure that they don't think I mentioned, but our money cost is a relatively small part of it doing business. Roughly 70% is our people and their ability to structure these deals. I think if we had any sense, we'd buy tax-free bonds and end up with four employees and make an awful lot of money with no headaches. We have plenty of headaches doing what we do. But no, we don't know the foreign market, and I think one reason we've been relatively successful, we're pretty well sustained things we know, and then generated new things, but done them in a place where we have to, which happens to be the United States.
I'm not sure you answered my question.
I'm not sure I did either, but I'll try again. You mean if money flows to the point of maximum and largest return, is that the place to put it?
Would you if you could?
Well, when you say if we could, first I think we'd have to, now, for example, we don't know anything about the real estate market. And there have been opportunities in the last few years with all the things, construction money, interim financing, et cetera, to make a good dollar in that field. Undeveloped property loans in my old home state of New Jersey, where my builder friends there were paying the equivalent of 13-14% of money they used to get to 6. But we didn't go into that field, even though we saw an opportunity, because we don't know the business. And when you get abroad, we know the business we'd like to do, but then you have to structure that within whether the people over there cause a demand, whether your legislation and laws and ordinances and whatnot permit you to operate in the fashion you feel is reasonable. And finally, you have to get proper personnel over there and train them.
Money on the minute was on a free international basis, and they're getting 16% in Germany, and they're getting 10% in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
or in the United States,
mm-hmm.
but not going to be a lot of money left in the United States. So if you're in the money loaning business, you're going to be loaning it from Europe, aren't you?
I think that was the purpose of the balance of payments regulation.
As a matter of fact, isn't a good deal of money invested in foreign markets, such as Asian banks, et cetera, et cetera? Because we don't, we
got
to get a better rate there than we do here.
Money did flow out, but not ours, of course, because we want to put it to work, not. Year to year, lots of different things in the business we're in, and probably make a lot of money and not need too many people to handle. But then that, it's every man to his own.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Anybody else on Senate Bill 311? Senate Bill 489, Mr. Russell.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My name is H.P. Russell, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association. We are the ones that suggested Bill 489, I have not prepared a statement today. It's a comparatively simple bill, and our reason for proposing such a measure is also comparatively simple. Primarily, the Mortgage Bankers Association represents not only mortgage bankers, but banks, state and federal banks, savings and loan associations, and so on. And during the tight money of last year, several of our members encountered a rather difficult situation in that for the smaller commercial type loans, shopping centers, small businesses, and this kind of thing, we found that clients, because of the usury laws, were required to incorporate and therefore lose the tax advantage of individual or partnership arrangements in financing their construction. Oregon, as you know, has always been a money-starved state, and anticipating additional expansion, we anticipate that will continue for some time. Before we came to this body, we did check with quite a number of people, several of the institutions that are not members of our organization, checked with representatives of labor and so forth, and found no opposition to our bill. We do not feel, and we've discussed this at some length, that our measure would materially affect residential construction, primarily because a number of the investors are aligned toward the commercial industrial type loans. A lot of them are aligned toward residential mortgages. And we don't feel it's going to make a material difference in that respect. And as much as usury, as we understand it, is primarily designed to protect the small uninformed individual, $50,000 we feel puts that outside of the category of the uninformed person. And that very simply is the statement. I'd rather answer the questions if we could.
All right. First, I'd ask you, are you familiar with Senate Bill 311?
Very casually, yes.
As I understand, the difference between that bill and 489 is the amount of $50,000. Also that you would be able to loan to individuals, partnerships, and so forth.
That is correct. Right. Yes.
Senator Groen.
What about your investor? If I were an investor and I had a choice to put my money, if I could buy a mortgage at 6, 7, 8%, by the same token, any loan above $50,000, the lid was off. Where would you put your money? Where would I put my money?
Well, typically, of course, Senator, the answer to your question is that you put your money where you can get the highest.
Now, you said these investors, though, are, there's one type of investor that wants home loans and the other type that goes for commercial loans. What would prevent that man that's investing in the mortgage market to say, well, look, I can get a greater return going in this buildings or other type of construction, loaning to corporations, therefore this is where the money's going. In a tight money situation, there's no money available for the mortgage market. They're all going into it.
Well, I suppose this could happen, Senator. Primarily what we're talking about, I think, is a matter of policy. Some institutions are fairly well committed. I represent a small state bank, as an example. And our policy has always been, and as far as I know will always be, that we're going to make automobile loans and residential mortgages and commercial loans and so forth. We are limited somewhat in the type of loan we can make as to the availability of money. But the fact that you can charge a high rate would not necessarily preclude the investment in these other items. Now, as it worked out last year, the choice was comparatively simple. The investors were talking, and I don't want to quote rates exactly, but as an example, they might quote a 9.5% interest rate with maybe 2% of the gross or something of that sort on a small shopping center. Under those circumstances, most of the investors were not willing to take a chance under our usury laws, so the simple answer was, I'm sorry, Mr. or Mr. Partnership, if that were the case, you have to be a corporation to do it. And as it worked out last year, the 12% seemed adequate under those circumstances. And I'm talking now just about mortgage loans. We must differentiate between that and other kinds of investments. The big point, as I say, was the fact that we are forcing people to lose the tax advantages, the old proprietorship or partnership or joint venture or something of this sort, because of the law.
Any questions?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vern Pearson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a copy of my statement which I'll hand out. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Vern Pearson, representing the United States National Bank. We support Senate Bill 489. The passage of this bill will assist in generating additional funds for construction and development loans in Oregon during periods of tight money. One of the most clearly established principles of economics is that markets operate most efficiently when prices are allowed to fluctuate in response to conditions of supply and demand. This principle also applies to interest rates on money. All states have enacted legislation which places a legal ceiling on the rate of interest to be charged on various types of loans. However, legal ceilings have not prevented interest rates from raising on a national level. They only prevent the borrowers encumbered by these restrictions from competing with those who are willing to pay the going rate. This is because of the wide variation in interest rate ceilings, not only among states, but within states as to different types of loans. As a result of Oregon's statutory ceiling of 10% on loans to individuals and 12% on loans to corporations, large sums of money which are available for construction and development loans in the real estate industry would not flow into Oregon. Rather, they flowed into states which permitted higher rates of interest. Statutory rate ceilings have generally been imposed under the principle that it protects persons with limited knowledge in the field of credit and finance for paying rates which society has felt were exorbitant. We do not propose to discuss the merits or demerits of this proposition this afternoon. We do wish to point out, however, that the retention of the present statutory ceiling on all loans of under $50,000 will continue to protect the unsophisticated borrower. We are talking here about loans to sophisticated borrowers who are willing to pay whatever price they have to pay borrow money to develop a project which they know in the final analysis will be profitable to them. During the recent credit crunch, we had many requests for loans which could not be filled because money flowed to other states where loans could be made at higher rates of interest. This caused many profitable and worthwhile projects to be put on the back burner and certainly helped to slow down the construction industry during that period and prevented the creation of additional jobs which would have resulted. One of the least things that the developer is concerned with is the interest rate on his construction loan, and as a result, if the project is potentially profitable, he is generally willing to pay whatever the market will bear to obtain needed financing. It is surprising to see some of the rates which have been paid in other states for construction and development loans during the recent tight money period. First Mortgage Investors, in a prospectus dated 1969, states that the annualized yield on first mortgage construction loans ranged from 9% to 13% for the 12 months ending April 30th, 1969, while development loans averaged 10% to 15% for the same period. The Bank of New York states in a research article on real estate investment trusts in October 1969, over the past several years, the emphasis has been on high-yielding first mortgage construction and development loans where yields of 12% to 18% are not uncommon. The state of Washington recently passed similar legislation which removed the statutory ceiling on loans of $100,000 and over. The state of California has no statutory ceiling on any loan made by a bank or savings and loan association. Oregon, which has been an historically capital short state, must be in a position to compete with its neighbors and indeed with all states of the Union in being able to attract these large sums of money which move to areas where the available interest rates are highest. Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to say that I talked to Mr. Whalen of the AFL-CIO, who had
indicated that he'd like to be here to speak in favor of this bill, but could not today because he had another hearing to be due. And Mr. Whalen authorized me to say that they have no objections to this bill. We urge your favorable support of Senate Bill 489. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Vern, your banks make out-of-state loans on the basis of and 15% for these construction loans and all these things. What's the reason for this?
Reason for that we don't?
Yeah.
Well, our money comes to us from Oregon people, and we feel that since we can't operate in any other state of the Union other than Oregon, that prosperity of our bank is dependent upon the prosperity of the state. And as a result, if we do move our money out of state, we're going to suffer along with the rest of the state. Now, I might add, Mr. Chairman, in order to clarify the situation and to give you another reason why we support this bill, is that we also own a mortgage company, Commerce Mortgage Company, which attracts money from out of state. They receive most of their money from insurance companies back east and also mutual savings banks in New York and eastern states. And this money does come into the state of Oregon through Commerce Mortgage Company. Commerce Mortgage Company, in addition, also has offices in the state of Washington and in the state of California. And some of this money then that is generated from out of state by Commerce Mortgage Company does go into the state of Washington and into the state of California, but not the depositor's money. Now, I might also add, so that somebody doesn't pin me down on this point, it's true that we do make loans to large national corporations, short-term working capital loans, but these loans are predicated upon their maintaining balances with us, and as a matter of policy, we have not made loans to national corporations which do not do business in the state of Oregon.
Same question I've asked previously.
Yeah, Bert.
What about, and I have heard from my banker that he feels that if this bill were to pass, that would hurt the home mortgage market.
I don't agree.
I think it's very important to.
I agree with that.
He's afraid that this money, his bank, would loan money to the corporate loan where they get a higher rate of interest than they would the homeowner. This is where I'm concerned.
It
hurt our mortgage market in this type of loan.
I think it's easy to sit down and probably to rationalize that thing on both sides of the fence. I don't agree that this would happen, Senator Miller, for this reason that what we're talking about here, when we're talking about the rates that I quoted to you in here from 13 to 15 and 12 to 18 and so on and so forth, we're talking about money which has been placed in construction and development loans. In other words, this is the construction financing, the interim financing, which is provided to get a shopping center built or an apartment house built or even a real estate tract built. And this type of a transaction attracts a different type of money than does long-term mortgage money for homes. Long-term mortgage money for homes generally attracts the small thrift depositor, which deposits in banks and mutual savings banks and savings and loan associations. And I would suspect that they would continue to make those deposits in there because they're usually relatively small deposits, which wouldn't come in for this type of a loan. What we're talking about here is the large sums of money which our investors have throughout the country that move to places where they can get the highest rate of interest on a short-term basis as opposed to the long-term basis when you're talking about a mortgage loan. In other words, normally your construction loan is a 24-month loan, or sometimes they go a little longer than that, but I think as a general rule we can say 24 months, and this type of money is not attracted to the long-term market.
One more question. You mentioned that during this tight money policy, there was no, very little money spent in Oregon at that time. Construction was down. But what about Standard Insurance? I don't know if they built during the tight money. I know Georgia Pacific improved their building during the tight money. First National, I think there was tight money policy when they decided to build their building. And I think you announced your plans for your new plant or addition to during the tight money period.
Well, I can't speak for Standard. Standard, I think, was considerably before that.
I think it was, but there were numerous, and
I can't speak for First National. I am Georgia Pacific, but in our case, our plans were, let's put it this way, announced rather prematurely, and as a matter of fact, we don't even have architect's drawings yet. This is something that's been in the long-term planning for quite some time, and one of the sharper newspaper reporters got a hold of the plan and indicated he was going to print an article on it and wanted to get some of the data, and somehow or other he had most of the data, which was what I would say would be a long-term plan, and our original intention was not to put in when money was still tight, but to go when money had loosened up somewhat.
I understood your original intention was to go 41 stories.
No.
One story.
No. No, we decided we either go 100 stories or 5 stories. We don't want to be anywhere near them.
Other questions? Thank you, Vern.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 378, Mr. Light. 378.
A very brief statement.
Excuse me, was there anybody else on 489 that wanted to speak?
I'm James Light, Jr. I'm an Assistant Vice President, Legal Department at First National Bank. But I'm appearing on behalf of the Legislative Committee of the Trust Division of the Oregon Bankers Association in support of Senate Bill 378. There is nothing prohibited by present law which would be permitted by enactment of this bill. However, this bill could remove considerable uncertainty which now exists and add some needed clarification to our law. On behalf of the Legislative Committee of the OBA Trust Division, I made a very informal survey of similar legislation in other states. My source was an estate planning service published by Prentice Hall. I found that at least 18 states have legislation of this type. The New York statute enacted in 61, I believe, is quite popular, and some 9 states seem to have copied it. In drafting Senate Bill 378, we started with the New York statute and borrowed some provisions from both the California and Maryland statutes, then of course made a few other changes to fit the situation here in Oregon. Our main purpose was to make it clear that the trustee of a testamentary trust, that is, a trust created under a person's will, may be named as beneficiary of life insurance on the testator's life. It seemed desirable, though, to cover other types of death benefits. So examples of other benefits are listed in Section 1, which is the definitions section of the bill. Likewise, most of the time we would be concerned with an, quote, insured as the person who would be designating a beneficiary of such benefits. But that term would not apply to pension or profit sharing funds and the like, so we used the word, quote, designator, as was done in the California statute. Obviously, an obligor is the person obligated to pay the death benefits. Section 2 of the bill may not really be necessary. It is pretty well established, I believe, that the trustee of an inter vivos trust, that is, a trust created by an agreement between the trustor and the trustee, typical life insurance trust, created during the trustor's lifetime, may be the beneficiary of life insurance proceeds and other death benefits. However, we have no statutory law to that effect, and most of the legislation in this area, which I reviewed, so provided, provided for the inter vivos trust as well. So for the sake of thoroughness, Section 2 was included in the bill before you. Section 3 and Section 4 are the parts of this bill which we feel are really needed to clarify and make more certain the status of the Oregon law. Section 3 provides, as I hope is perfectly clear, that a testamentary trustee may be designated as beneficiary of life insurance proceeds or death benefits under other types of plans described in Section 1. Section 3 would also give notice to the obligor on such benefits, such as an insurance company, when it is safe to pay such proceeds. Section 4 now would be considered by most Oregon lawyers as the most important part of the bill. As you know, there may be different inheritance tax treatment of such death benefits, depending upon whether they are payable to a, quote, named beneficiary or to a decedent's estate. Many people in estate planning work have been concerned that the Oregon taxing authorities might treat a testamentary trust beneficiary designation the same as a designation of the decedent's estate as such beneficiary with adverse tax consequences. To my knowledge, neither the state treasurer nor the inheritance tax division of the Department of Revenue has ever taken that position, but that does not mean that they might not try something. This section would provide some certainty that has long been needed. Sections 5 and 6 are routine, I believe, and self-explanatory. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you on behalf of this bill. If you have any questions, I shall attempt to answer them as best I can. Thank you.
Questions? If I understand the bill, then, that a person or the obligor, I guess, if he wants to set up an estate, he can do it through your trust department, and that.
Well, as it is now,
all of his life insurance, anything, and then this would go through the trust department to the beneficiary.
That's about the only, or at least most lawyers feel that's about the only safe way to do it now. The so-called life insurance trust agreement. You come in and set up a trust agreement with a trust company or any trustee. And name that trust as a beneficiary. And a lot of attorneys and a lot of people feel, why shouldn't you be able to just create a trust under your will, not get the bank or trustee involved at this stage? Wait till after the need for the services arrive. So have a trust spelled out in your will, name, have your insurance beneficiary designation, Joe Blow, a trustee under my last will and testament. And the insurance company would say to pay to the trustee once the will was admitted to the program. And people have been a little wary of doing this. Completely uncontroversial.
Is this like anti-attorney's
bill? I think it's a pro-attorney's bill. You need an attorney either way. I mean, the trust company certainly won't draft life insurance trusts without an attorney. And grant, and nobody will touch a will except an attorney.
There's a loophole. There's a loophole for taxes, for inheritance taxes.
Is it a loophole? We think it does exactly what it's done now, but people have worried about what position the taxing authorities might take. Unofficially, they've taken the position all in the past as we had the bill. So it would not, I don't think, Department of Revenue would be opposed to this.
Last question in chat, sort of state taxes. When is the determined value of, say, bonds or stocks? When is that determined? Is that the time of death, or is this a...
It's the time of death for Oregon inheritance tax purposes. Federal law, you may have an alternate valuation date.
Oregon's time of death. So sections 4 wouldn't affect this.
No, it's the same as it is.
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else on 378? All right. Senate Bill 381. Mr. Butler.
Mm-hmm.
Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Herbert E. Butler. I'm a vice president and trust officer at United States National Bank. I am here as a representative of the Legislative Committee, Trust Division, Oregon Bankers Association. Section 2 of ORS 57.170, in its present form, prohibits the voting of treasury shares or shares of its own stock held by a corporation in a fiduciary capacity. Senate Bill 381, generally speaking, would change this so as to conform Oregon law to federal law and to the regulations of the Comptroller of the Currency relating to shares of its own stock held by a national banking association in a fiduciary capacity, in that it would permit an Oregon corporation holding shares of its own stock under the terms of a trust which authorizes voting as determined by the trustee or some other designated person such as a beneficiary to vote those shares in the manner directed by the person so authorized. So it means that if one of the state banks, for example, holds its own shares in a trust, and if the person who created that trust has authorized the bank as the trustee to vote those shares, either specifically or generally, then the bank as trustee would have the authority to vote, so long as it did so in keeping with the specifications of the authority contained in the trust instrument.
That'd be for directors or?
That's right. For example, at present, the regulations of the Comptroller of the Currency specify, generally speaking, that in the absence of restrictions in a trust instrument, a national bank may vote shares of its own stock held in trust as it deems appropriate, except that in voting those shares for election of directors, it can only vote as directed by some designated authorized person.
And this could designate the bank as the authorized person to vote these shares.
That's right.
For a director or for any reason.
That's right.
That's one more question. Yeah. What does it mean for this deal? Do you have some?
Well, I suppose the thing that has actually triggered it was the fact that until a year or so ago, we at the U.S. National were a national banking association and held shares of our own stock in trust and were able to vote those in keeping with the U.S. code and the regulations of the Comptroller of the Currency. Then the corporate structure was changed by reason of the changeover to a one-bank holding company status, and where we had been a national banking association holding shares of our own national banking association stock, we became an Oregon corporation and were subject to the restrictions of ORS 57.170 Section 2.
Then this would apply to your state chartered banks.
That's right. As a matter of fact, Mr. Peary of the Oregon Bank is here. He, I'm sure, will agree that they consider this to be desirable legislation. I have copies of it have been sent to all of the banks in the state of Oregon that have trust powers, either verbally or in writing, those that are active in the administration of trust have expressed their entire approval with the bill.
Other questions?
Well,
yes.
Well, could we? Did I miss much on this bill? Did he say to accomplish what end? To what end? Did he answer that question?
What?
Could we try this, in deference to, well, before you answer, in deference to reasonably limited intellect in English, what will this ease or expedite or facilitate or accomplish?
Well, many of the customers of trust departments of the banks in Oregon are people who hold shares of those banks. They go back, in many cases, for a number of generations. They're shares that have been passed down from one generation to another. In many of these cases, the owners have decided that for one reason or another, it is better that they leave their estates or portions of them in trust with the bank for administration of family members rather than making outright distributions. They have a great sentimental attachment to these shares of stock that they hold, and they do not want those shares sterilized, so to speak. They want the shares to continue to have a voice in the management of the bank's affairs. In its present form, any bank that is an Oregon corporation that holds its own stock in trust, regardless of what the trust instrument itself may say, is prohibited by state statute from voting those shares, regardless of the wishes of the person who created the trust. And it is to overcome this limitation that this legislation is proposed.
In certain funds the banks can, first the national banks can.
A national bank can because it's not subject to the restriction of the state code.
What kind of bank will be able to do it if this passes?
Examples would include Oregon Bank, First State Bank of Oregon, Western Bank, Security Bank.
So you're bringing yourselves at par with the U.S. and the First National Bank in this power?
Well, the U.S. finds itself in the same position because it's now an Oregon corporation, the U.S. Bancorp.
Bring yourself to par with First National Bank.
That's right.
Good. That's a good bill.
Chairman, I move it out. Senate Bill 381. Nothing more. You want to get
anything further, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Why was
he involved in the work session?
The way it was.
I'm sorry I can't answer that. I don't know why. It applies not only in its present form to shares held by a trust company, but also to trading shares of any corporation. This does not have, does not change the law with respect to treasury shares.
Because of the ability of people to recommend to those people what they would do with their shares, a heavier emphasis on what they might do with the fact that particular bank is perpetuating that particular bank in the board of directors against maybe investors.
Well, the law in its present form begins by talking about treasury shares, and I wonder if maybe the reason for existence of the law in its present form may not be to prevent someone who is in control of a corporation, even though he may have a minority interest, through the voting of treasury shares to control the affairs of the corporation regardless of the wishes of majority holders. I can see that it would be with respect to treasury shares, yes.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
What's a treasury share, please?
Well, I'm sure members of your committee can answer that better than I, but
I'm sure we all can. I just wanted to embarrass the other.
As I understand it, it would be shares that have originally been issued in outstanding, which have been reacquired by the corporation. And are held as part of its capitalization.
So an individual, they're not securities owned by an individual held in trust as part of an entity, where he's the transfer agent shows him as the owner of the share.
The corporation would be the owner of its own
right.
Shares. Yes.
I got it.
Further questions? All right. Thank you very much. Senate Bill 392. Mr. Hart.
Mr. Chairman, I have prepared a written statement, also copies of the Chairman, my name is Alan Hart. I have prepared a written statement that I would like to more briefly than it is said it in writing. I'm a fortunate attorney, and I represent the People's Utility District's Directors Association, at whose request this bill was introduced. However, the bill deals or is of concern not only to People's Utility Districts, but indeed to all public bond state and counties and cities and all of their political subdivisions. I've also handed around, along with my statement, a copy of some bit of ORS 288510, which is the section of the code which this bill proposed to repeal. I would like to give a little background on that statute, ORS 288510. In 1969, for many years before that, there were scattered throughout the Oregon Code in the various acts authorizing and enabling cities and counties and political subdivisions of all kinds of issue bonds, there were in all of these enabling acts statutory, or many of them, statutory restrictions on the interest rates which could be charged. Most of those interest rates were specified as 6%. Many of the statutes also permitted sales of bonds at up to a 2% discount. Some of them required sales at par, not less than par. Now, in 1969, with interest rates climbing, many of these political subdivisions, the state, the county, the cities, and political subdivisions, were confronted by the fact that their 6% interest rate ceilings were going to exclude them from the market. And rather than attempt to amend each and every one of those separate statutes, this committee, the Financial Affairs Committee at the 1969 session, introduced a bill, Senate Bill 261, which provided that, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, and then it referred to all the states and all municipal corporations and political subdivisions, may interest their bonds shall bear interest at not to exceed such maximum rate, and may be sold at not less than 98% of par, as the governing commission, board, or other body or person may deem appropriate. That bill, at the 1969 session, was introduced by this committee at the request of the state treasurer. This committee recommended that it do pass, and it did pass the Senate. When it reached the House, however, it was very drastically amended. It was amended in the first place to provide that it would apply only to state bonds, rather than the bonds of state and municipals and counties and all political subdivisions. In the second place, instead of providing that it that the bonds could carry such rate as the issuing agency should determine or deem appropriate, a 6.5% ceiling was written in the House. And in that form, it passed the House in the 1969 session. Then in conference, the bill was again drastically revised in the closing days of the session, and it was put into the form that you see in ORS 288-510-9. It was again made applicable to not only the state, but to the cities and counties and all political subdivisions. That was restored. The 6.5% ceiling adopted by the House was increased to 7%, and then the conference committee added the final clause requiring all public bonds be sold at not less than par value. And that is where you see ORS 288-510 now. That's the provision they have for us. It applies to all the state and all political subdivisions. It fixes a 7% interest ceiling, and it requires all public bonds be sold at not less than par. Now, The committee, of course, knows what happened to interest rates during the past 2 years, and the other witnesses who will follow me on this bill will speak to the merits of this question of an interest rate ceiling and the requirement that bonds be sold at not less than par, rather than permitting a discount, as most many statutes do, of up to 2%. I would like to tell the committee, however, that because of the difficulties that this 1969 law, 288.510, has created for the state and political subdivisions, there have been introduced several bills in this legislature which are dealing with this same question that we're concerned with in Senate Bill 392. In the first place, House Bill 1133 was introduced, and it would amend the same section, 288.510, to exempt ports, water districts, and interstate bridge bonds from the requirements of 288.510. Now, I mentioned that bill, HB 1133, in my written statement. Since I prepared my written statement, I have learned that 1133 has been amended to make it apply only to ports, to exempt only ports from 288.510, and also to add the provision that the ports may sell their bonds at the up to 2% discount, which we think is desirable. And as such, it has been passed by the House. This is since I prepared my statement Friday afternoon. I learned it since I prepared my statement Friday afternoon.
But which bill is that passed the House?
HB 1133, and according to 1133, and according to the calendar, which I received today, it has been referred to the state, to the Senate Committee on State and Federal Affairs. State Federal Affairs referred on March 17th. So that's one bill that is struggling with this problem that was created by the 1969 Act. Secondly, there are two other bills. 1025, I think it is, deals with this problem, and Senate Bill 392 was introduced at our request to deal with PUD bonds on a specific basis. The most important other bill dealing with this problem, however, is House Bill 1454, which was introduced at the request of the Oregon State Bar. It has the same objective as Senate Bill 392 to eliminate the statutory, comprehensive, statewide statutory interest rate ceiling. However, 1454 would accomplish that result by a different means, by amending 288.510 rather than by repealing it. Now, I would like to say to the committee that since we prepared and then asked for the introduction of this Senate Bill 392 to repeal 288.510, it has been called to our attention that the outright repeal of 288.510 would revive these 6% interest rate ceilings that are now in effect for in so many of the enabling acts for different kinds of districts and municipal counties. And we are therefore in agreement that it would be wiser to amend 288.510 rather than repeal as we have as now accomplished by Senate Bill 392.
So amendment, which one now?
We would like to propose to the committee that 392, the bill we're discussing, be changed, and instead of repealing 288.510, we would like to request that it amend the same section to read as in the manner I'm now handing out.
So if Urban Affairs moves to amend it, both 1454 and 392 would be adopted.
Yes, sir. Now I might say in response to that, Senator, that I learned too late to attend that there was a hearing by the House Urban Affairs Committee on last Thursday afternoon on 1454. At that time, I got in touch with Mr. Howard Rankin, who does a lot of bond work in this state, and he and I got in touch with the Oregon State Bar people, and at the hearing before Urban Affairs last Thursday afternoon, the Oregon State Bar requested the amendment of 1454 to conform exactly with the proposed amendment that I have just handed out. So the fact that 1454 and 392 would be identical. Now, Director,
could I ask you a question? Yes,
sir. This
1454, why did the Oregon State Bar introduce this bill? Do you know?
I talked to the chairman of the committee, Mr. Senator McKay, Mr. Cordes, who said that his committee on local government, of the Oregon State Bar, had inherited this bill from a previous committee, and he didn't have much background. I don't really know the answer to that. But it was presented to the State Bar Convention, and the State Bar did authorize the request for the introduction of and the support for 1454, and they are in accord with amending 1454 to read in the manner that I am suggesting here. So that if this committee were to accede to the request that I'm now making for the amendment of 392 in this fashion, all of the sponsors of this situation would be seeking the same legislation verbatim. Now, I'd like to point out that the amendment which we are proposing would provide that, notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, all bonds issued by the state, city, county, port, subdivision, any other public corporation shall bear interest at the rate or rates provided in the bid accepted by the governing body or person responsible under applicable law for issuing the bonds. Thus, we would do away with the comprehensive and the individual statutory rate ceilings. And the other witnesses that I say who will speak on this bill following me will explain the reasons for this and will speak in support of the merits of that issue. I'd like to point out also, however, that our proposed amendment would delete the words "and shall be sold at not less than par value." The purpose here is to revive the various statutory provisions now existing in each of the various parts of the code, applicable to municipalities, counties, ports, school districts, irrigation districts, as to whether or not the bonds may be sold at par or at less than par. In my written statement, I have cited various examples of the present statutes which authorize sales either at par in some cases or at 98% of par in other instances. We are simply saying that instead of having a comprehensive statute requiring all public bonds to be sold at not less than par, we should restore the right of those agencies which have the right or previously have had the right to use the sale at up to 2% discount. Other witnesses today also will tell you, the committee, that this right to sell at up to 2% discount is of value. It enables the bond issuing entities to sell their bonds at lower cost. But my mission is not to speak to the merits of these two problems. You simply sketch this background of how this problem comes before the committee today. It was created, I think, rather ill-advisedly at the last minute by a conference committee. It was not what this committee, this Financial Affairs Committee, had recommended to the legislature. It was really not what the House Committee had recommended. It was passed in the very closing days of the session in the form recommended by a conference committee. And it has not worked well, and it needs to be corrected. And as I say, the amendment we are proposing would put us in line with what the Oregon State Bar is also proposing, and the two bills are therefore
any more questions? How many times in the past year or during this tight money policy has the PUDs held in elections where bonds were approved by the electorate in that particular district and the board has been able to sell them? Because of the low interest, the 7%.
Yeah.
Senator, instances or cases?
I think there have been none. I think we have stayed out of the bond market because of fear that bonds could not be sold at that rate. Now, so far as the only district, I represent the Central Lincoln Teachers District, and I'm more familiar with its internal affairs than I am with the other districts. And I know that this has required deferment on some construction, but they have been able to live with it. If they had had a crisis, of course, or they had to have construction, it would have been more of a handicap.
Now, our sewer district there sold bonds at District 1 at 7%, and there have been other cases recently where the bonds have been sold at 7%. And
right now, I think that the bond market is, the interest rates are low, so.
I think that's true, Senator. Of course.
Is your problem really one that, as far as how would this affect you anyhow? You have to have a vote of the people, and this has been difficult as far as the PUDs are concerned.
Oh, no. We've had.
How many bond issues have you had passed in the past prior to this?
Well, the district I'm familiar with, we've had, I should suppose, maybe 20 in the last 15 in the last 20 years.
The electric have approved.
By an 80% to 90% margin. Yes, we've had no problem with bond elections. But the we of course, feel that it is impossible for this legislature to foresee what problems various municipal corporations may encounter requiring financing during the next 2 years, nor can the legislature foresee what's going to happen to interest rates in the next 2 years. And we think that, therefore, this legislation is desirable.
What do you feel, Mr. Chairman, what do you feel it would be an open invitation to take the lid off to allow the banks to, or any institution that buys your bonds to do so at a higher rate?
I really don't think so, Senator, because there is no incentive, there's no inducement to management of our kind of district or to the other kinds of municipal corporations whose bonds we're talking about here to go ahead at a rate of interest which they cannot justify and cannot stand within their own operations. I don't think it's going to encourage unwise borrowing.
Now, I have a question, Al. I'm not trying to play a lawyer, but governing body, this is the new language. What's the governing body of Oregon?
Well, I think that language would not be applicable. It's the person responsible under applicable law for issuing the bond. I suppose that that could be the state treasurer in this case.
All right, so that if it's Straub or if it's Saltfeld or whoever it is, you're not going to get hooked in the case of any state-issued bonds, but it was governing body.
I think not. I might say that this language was reviewed by Mr. Rankin, and in fact, he helped to draft it. So I think it's
other questions?
Thank you very much. Ken Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Johnson, Deputy State Treasurer. State Treasurer Straub had intended to appear today in support of Senate Bill 392, and he flew home with the flu. Called in this morning to say he couldn't make it and asked me to appear on his behalf. As Mr. Hart has mentioned, the state treasurer did ask in the last session for legislation to remove the interest ceiling entirely, and he continues to support that move as this amended Senate Bill 392 would do. We have two practical reasons for, at the state level, for wanting to see construction occur and bonding made more easy. One, of course, is that many of our state agencies depend upon the bonding, higher education, veterans, highway, forests, and so on, and now currently the pollution control bonding. The second reason is, and this is a little less known, I think, that our state's bond rating is to a certain extent determined. It's presently double A. By the state's ability to maintain the states and the political subdivisions of ability to maintain their physical plant in good condition. When we go to bid now with our bonds, one of the points we make as a selling point, as we hold attraction for low bids, is that this is a state that takes care of its physical plant. It is not allowing it to run down. Now, if you get a period where bond has become difficult or impossible, and very quickly your physical plant deteriorates, this does make you a poor credit risk in a way. So, again, this is not as important as from the state treasury department standpoint as the direct question of state agencies that are bonding. Nevertheless, we are interested in what the local public political subdivisions can do in this capacity. Now, this amendment would do two basic things. It would remove the interest ceiling entirely on public bonds, and I would like to trace just a little history for you then on interest ceilings. During the last session, as you've heard, the ceiling of 6.5% was actually inserted into the House measure, and we wound up with 7%. At the time this was done, we had issued a veterans bond at 3.8%. That was a fairly small issue, but at 3.8%, people were saying, well, it'll never go over 5. Within that same biennium, we issued a $4 million 11F higher ed self-liquidating issue at 6.9%. That's an 80% jump within the biennium, during which period the legislature was not in session and had no power to help us. We very, very nearly, and this is at the state level, very nearly reached that 7%. If we were to get the same kind of a growth in interest rates in the coming biennium, and it is just as possible as it was in the last one, that is an 80% growth, we would jump from our last issue, which was about 4.25%, to about 7.5% within this biennium. So it seems very possible that the 7% limitation could hold us down. In other words, that would be the kind of, we'd have to look at 7.5% national rates, and we simply wouldn't be able to issue the bonds. So we are interested in this limit. The treasurer feels that the limit is totally artificial and arbitrary. It has no meaning. That the market should determine the interest rate, along with the governing bodies or individuals who, in their judgment, can decide whether or not to sell bonds when they're going to get that kind of rate. And even after the bids are received, they have the option to decide whether they'll accept them or not. Now, the second aspect of this is the discount. Allowance. Certain public bonds now can be discounted 2%. I beg your pardon, under the present law, we have no discount, but this amendment would return us to statutes that does allow discounted bonds 2%. In our experience, the discount is helpful in this respect. A bond buyer who is in turn going to resell bonds finds it easier to do when he can buy the bonds at 98% and sell them at par rather than to have to ask for a premium. And so, that being the case, the fact that they are more resaleable for him, we have the feeling that he's able to come in with a little lower bid. It takes probably less time to dispose of the issue. He probably spends less money to dispose of the issue. And when he's making his bid, he can take that into account and move his food costs down. Now, it's our calculation that in a 30-year issue, averaging something perhaps under 15 redemption, 15 years, a saving of 1/8% in the bid, or a bid of 1/8% or more, would offset this discount. So we feel that at least psychologically and probably monetarily, this enhances the ability of the subdivision to issue its bonds. I think that covers the main points that the Treasurer would like to make. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions.
I recall Ken, many years ago, when we built the Astoria Maker Bridge, that Oregon's credit rating was so far superior to our neighbors, it was cheaper for Oregon to bond constructing that bridge and lend the entire credit to the state of Oregon to take a lien on Washington Highway revenue for the purpose of repaying Oregon. There's the Washington chair. And our rate was lower than most of our neighboring states because we had better credit rating. Now, it seems to me that this is what really counts, is that Oregon has a good credit rating and can bond cheaper than our neighboring states. Isn't this true?
It's debatable. We're a little concerned currently about our AA rate. Of course, Washington also has a AA rating. To say that we have a better credit rating, I'm not sure that would be true, but in any event, it's a precarious sort of thing, this so-called credit rating. And as we have said, you may appear to have a good credit rating and let your plant slip a little bit and you might lose it.
Well,
it's very arbitrary.
Just a minute, under our Constitution, we have to operate in the black. Neighboring states, this is not true. Mm-hmm. They can operate in the red. I think this has helped our credit rating, don't you? I mean, I don't know where you, mm-hmm. as far as the physical plant is concerned, I would doubt this very much. It would have much in anything to do with it. It seems to me that it's where your ability to pay your bills and you have to live within your budget, and as any good business would, or the state of Oregon must operate along these lines. Mm-hmm. This thing should enhance our credit rating.
Well, our credit rating is what other people say it is. Our credit rating is what bond raters say
well,
it is.
Well, certainly this would help us.
And other states, many other states, do not have a limit. I couldn't tell you conclusively one way or the other that their credit ratings are affected by the fact, either down or up, by the fact that they do not have limitations on their bonding. I think something like half of the states do not. Oregon is in a minority in the sense of having, well, we're among, I think, about 9 states that have a limit of 7% or less on both state and local general obligation bonding. If this were going to be important in terms of good credit rating, then we should be AAA, because we're in a very small group.
One more question. Do you know of any project in the state of Oregon that's now suffering because of the 7% limitation? One project now?
No. We're down now. Now we're able to sell bonds for 4.25%.
All right.
Last time, the project that I mentioned during the last financing was a $4 million dormitory issue for higher education. It came within 0.1% of the 7% limit, and would not have been issued and sold if it had been just that tiny bit higher. And I don't know what projects. Mr. Hart has mentioned the fact that the PUDs would say, "Well, let's just not go to the bond market." I have no idea how many planters have had to say the
do that, certainly they want to have an interest rate limitation. Probably they're thinking in terms of their limitations, if they're going to have an effective Keynesian economic policy, I would say.
That's a good point, because what we do when we have an interest rate limitation is tie ourselves to federal policy. And this is not always what we want to do. We didn't, certainly this state did not agree with the federal policy. And housing and construction were the areas in which to stabilize the economy of the United States. We think the state of Oregon should be free then of this kind of restriction and influence. But as long as they do have us down to 7%, yes, the federal government can shoot the interest rates up, and they can shut down their building because we can't even bond. So in a sense, we're playing into the hands of the tight money policy when we have such an interest rate limitation.
Well, but there are, what you said, 41 states, if you subtract the 9, that don't have the interest rate limitation, and hence, as you said, would not be tied to federal policy in the event, you know, they were putting the damper on the spending. Right.
Yes, I think I didn't make it clear what I was talking about with the 9. There are not 41 states that do not have an interest rate limitation. There are 41 that have an interest rate limitation, either no interest rate limitation, or
higher,
one that is higher
than
others. Right.
So they're not tied to federal government.
Up to 10.
All right. So the other part of the equation comes in, that Senator Wingard's point is well taken, but the one that's not been made at all is the deleterious effect upon our position in the municipal bond market. In other words, we are caught at a gross, we stay at 7, and of the other 41, they're either non-existent or up to 10. Fine, where would you shop if you were, as long as municipals remain tax exempt? You wouldn't shop here, would you? And therefore, ours, even under 7, the other question was asked you was, in the debate last time, that famous, the last two sessions, famous bond interest rate authority, who's no longer with us, Senator Husband, felt that 7% was grossly out of line and that it should have stayed at 5. Senator Hoyt happened to join in the debate, I recall distinctly. Well, we will have to say that under the FRB and the prime rate policies that went on, 5, we will have to concede, would have been relatively inadequate. We may have to.
I think this does point out the fact, and I think all of us would agree, that Senator Husband, with a lot of background and experience in this field, could have been expected to make as educated a guess as anyone, and he missed by a long way. And I think this is not saying anything against Senator Husband. It's describing what the situation is and what could well happen to us. The state treasurer is also a fiscal expert, and he can sit here and make you a guess as to what interest rates might go to in the coming biennium, and he could be off by 2 points. It's that question.
All right, further questions?
Just following that up.
Senator Carson.
Johnson, the state treasurer wouldn't call this either a blank check or a giveaway.
No, sir. No, sir.
There's no argument.
This would also cover veterans bonds. Yeah, there'd be no limit on veterans bonds.
That's right.
All right, Mr. Brown.
Is this opposition?
Chairman, this is Mr. Brown. I'll introduce himself. We have a written testimony.
We recognize Senator Stafford.
Legislation.
The chairman and members of the blank check.
I am John E. Brown, treasurer of the Eugene Water and Electric Board. I want to express appreciation from my board for the opportunity to present our comments on Senate Bill 392 to you today. The Eugene Water and Electric Board is an administrative unit of the City of Eugene. Pursuant to the city charter, the responsibilities delegated to the board are conducted under the direction of 5 commissioners elected to the office by the electors of the city for a term of 5 years. We provide water and electric service to customers within the city of Eugene and also provide electric service to areas outside the city. EWED presently has about 43,000 electric customers and 22,000 water customers. In addition, it serves 4 water districts which provide water service to approximately 8,000 customers. Presently, under the provisions of Section 288.510, Oregon Revised Statute, quote, all bonds issued by this state, a city or its agency, a county, a court, a political subdivision, or any other public corporation shall bear interest at not to exceed a net effective rate of 7% and shall be sold at not less than par value, end quote. This provision pertains to both the general obligation bonds and revenue bonds. Debt created through general obligation bonds secured by the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the issuer. Revenue bonds, on the other hand, are secured by a lien on the earnings of the facility owned and operated by the local agency. Though possibly a more expensive means of financing, use of revenue bonds by EWEB reserves the general obligation borrowing capacity local school districts and the City of Eugene for further governmental purposes. The Eugene Water and Electric Board finances its operations through the sale of revenue bonds, which usually involve a higher net interest cost than general obligation bonds, simply because the taxing power of the city is not pledged as security. EWEB's most recent revenue bond sale was in August 1968 at a net effective rate of 4.8%. In the year that followed, August 1968 to September 1969, the average rate on high-grade municipal bonds traded in the open market increased nearly 50% and subsequently rose to a high exceeding 70% in May 1970. The most recent 3 quarters have seen a continuation of wide fluctuations in the net effective rate on tax-exempt bonds, trending downward, but the situation remains unstable. As we are all aware, we continue to experience relatively high interest rates. Eugene Water and Electric Board favors or enjoys a favorable bond rating. However, there were 2 periods totaling approximately 6 months during the last 1.5 years when we could not have sold revenue bonds because of the present 7% statutory limitation. At our financing program,
I have a question there. Do you have any idea what the interest rate might have been that you had to accept?
Well, I do know that in May 1970, the Dow Jones 20 bond index got as high as 7.12. And I know from experience over the years of issuing revenue bonds that Eugene Water and Electric Board pays approximately 0.5 percentage point above the 20 bond index. So it would have been close to 7.5. At our financing program, requiring a bond sale during this time, it would have necessitated a delay in construction, which, beyond the other problems, would very likely have meant increased construction costs due to escalation. Considering the fact that periods of high interest rates usually accompany periods of inflation, it is a fair assumption that when interest rates exceed the present limitation, the effects of escalation during a wait for lower rates would at least offset, if not exceed, savings and interest costs. We feel scheduling a new project or completing a partially constructed project should be more related to the need for the facility at any particular time, rather than our ability to sell bonds within the 7% limitation. With the present instability in the economy, and also because the Oregon legislature meets only biannually, it appears to us that the public interest would be best served by removing the interest limitation. In my opinion, in addition to the removal of the 7% interest rate limitation, the restriction for sale of bonds at not less than par should be removed. We recognize that smaller public agencies and schools prefer par sales, and in some cases actually must have them, but do not believe that the removal of the statutory requirement will adversely affect these agencies. There is no reason to believe that removal of this requirement for par bids would mean that they would not receive par bids, and the agency always has the option to require par bids in its bond resolution. Most often, bids on large revenue bond issues are made by syndicates comprised of several investment bankers who resell the bonds to individuals and financial institutions. The syndicate expects to earn a return on its investment and compensation for its organizational efforts, plus a factor for the risk it assumes in the purchase. With the present limitation on par sales, the coupon rate paid by the syndicate must be high enough to permit the resale of the bonds at a premium in order that it may be properly compensated. Paying a premium often tends to be complicating and confusing in the eyes of the ultimate purchaser and places the issuers of revenue bonds at a distinct disadvantage. Conversely, with a par sale limitation, bonds could be bid at the true coupon rate and sold to the syndicate of investment bankers at a discount sufficient to compensate them for the services and risk. These bonds would then be reoffered for sale to the ultimate purchaser at par. This transaction, in the eyes of the ultimate purchaser, is clear and simple, and he can easily determine what his return is by applying the coupon rate to the par value purchase price. With so many municipalities and local agencies competing for the dollars in the money market, this ability to sell to the ultimate owner at par is a distinct advantage in marketing bonds. The net effective rate of interest to the issuing agency would be the same regardless of which of the two approaches is taken. You may be interested to know that a recent survey indicates at least 10 states have increased or removed interest rate limitations during the past 2 years. An additional 18 states do not impose a limit on local agency bond interest rates, which I believe demonstrates that the Oregon legislature is not alone in its efforts to give local agencies the greatest possible latitude in marketing bonds. We urge your favorable consideration of Senate Bill 392. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Jack Madden.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jack Madison. I'm manager of Tillamook BUD, and I speak for the Oregon BUD Directors Association. High interest rates have been a problem. If we at Tillamook were faced with a bond issue in which the bankers indicated our effective interest rate would exceed 7%, we will change our program, defer construction, use all of the funds that we had available in the various cash funds in such a fashion as to borrow the minimum amount of money that was necessary. if the bid still came in exceeding the effective interest rate today, it could hurt the utility district, particularly if you had an industry located in your community that needed capital to build the electric facilities to serve. It might be most practical to pay more than 7% on small amounts of money for short periods of time, perhaps. The latitude of the board of directors in setting the life of the bonds or the effective interest rate, you might be able to choose the most business-like way to run the business. As it is today, not being able to sell them below par and the limit on the interest rate of 7%, there isn't any way to shuffle the cards to get the best deal for the most money or for the least money. We've talked with the investment bankers about 2% discount. In our history, no investment banker has taken the 2% discount. They've gone as high as 1.5 on it. That 1.5 gauged against the interest rates they charged was the least effective interest rate to the district. It actually cost the district less money to pay him, to let him have his 1.5% discount. But over the 30-year life of bonds, we ended up paying less money for the sale. We think this amendment Mr. Hart has offered is practical. It's needed. It's not needed today because we could sell bonds at less than 7%. But we don't know what's going to happen next year or the year after. And we'd like you to consider it in that fashion.
Well, thank you very much, Jack. Go on to the short work session. Senator Broner, you had a bill that you were vitally interested in.
Only funding to trigger up the May.
381.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm not supposed to. I'd like to spend a little.
That's total.
She just
anybody says in this committee, or in any committee, I'd like to spend a little time thinking.
Watch out, yeah, what the man can do.
Alright, see, let me, I think that's it, and I wanted to ask if you have something on.
280, I tried to get hold of Tom Scanlon, but he's been ill from the day we made that discussion, and there's a message on his bed when he comes out of his coma, or whatever he's in.
What number?
280, that's.
Right, you're interested, taking.
Well, listen, I don't want to take a much of a longer look at that.
It's starting to grow hair.
Right, I'd like to take it alone.
Well, I'd like to wait, Tom's.
He wants to take a little look.
Oh, no, take a little look at